But we begin with the online response to the Boston Marathon explosions. From anticipated weather events to breaking news, many people now turn first to social media to react and interact after a crisis. Monday's devastating attack was no exception. Shortly after two explosions rocked Copley Square near the Boston Marathon finish line, the internet was flooded with graphic photos, video uploads from witnesses, and tools to help loved ones connect with runners and spectators at the race. What happens online is now an essential part of how we view, respond to, and investigate disasters. With that in mind, Brady Carlson, NHPR's host of All Things Considered and our in-house expert on all things internet, is with us to parse through what worked and what didn't. Brady, thanks so much for joining us.
It's nice to be with you.
Now, we've talked about how social media has become essential during breaking news. We have the capacity for real-time updates. Real people act as citizen journalists. So let's look at Monday's events. Can you give us a snapshot of the role social media is playing right now and how it's evolved?
Well, notice first how social media has become a big part of the practical on-the-ground response to a crisis. It's not simply that people are documenting it and letting other people know that something happened, but it's actually as basic as police and investigators asking the public for smartphone videos, right, or photos that they may have taken just in case they may have seen something. It's as simple as the Red Cross telling people to text their friends to let them know they're okay, to use Twitter and Facebook to put the word out so that people aren't wondering if this person is missing or unaccounted for. Public officials tweeting updates about where people can get information about missing loved ones, where people should not go in the city until further notice. We've even gotten to the point now where there's a sub-forum on the site Reddit where people are trying to sort through the evidence themselves. It's like a big Reddit-wide crowdsourced criminal investigation. On top of all of that, though, there's this unconscious playbook that has been evolving about how we as broader web culture and people in that have respond to a tragedy. I mean, first we document the event. We share the information that we know. We share ways to help. And then we have our own personal reactions. And then we have the kind of communal reaction. So at first we're saying, oh, I heard from my friend, he or she is okay. And then we start sharing the memes of, you know, the New York Yankees playing Sweet Caroline to honor the Red Sox, or the striking stories that come out of the tragedy.
Well, let's dig into this a little. First, the documenting of the event and how social media shows us what perhaps news outlets will not. I have to admit, I did not look at a lot of these video feeds. I found them absolutely, absolutely upsetting. And this has become sort of the language of the web on some level.
It really is. I mean, if you notice in the last year, Facebook has been moving increasingly toward that more visual layout, and that's what's going to be the standard for everybody in the next few months. There's Tumblr, Pinterest, Instagram. They're all about visuals, photos, and videos. Now, people who have been following conflicts in other parts of the world, this is not news to them. People who have been following Syria know all about the very graphic cell phone footage that's coming out of Syria almost on a daily basis, and that's one example. But for most of us in the U.S., this is really the first event since that move to the more visually heavy social media where there's a lot of graphic content coming at us all after this one violent event.
But I've also heard of cases of people actually watching those videos, seeing, in fact, a couple from Concord, New Hampshire, identifying their son as one of the injured.
Yeah, and I think that's also something that's really important to note. I mean, as this information is coming out, we talk about the web being able to personalize what we see. And to a certain extent, that's true. But at the same time, in social media, you're not just seeing what you want to see. You're also seeing what your friends want you to see. And with this move toward sharing information very quickly and, you know, frictionless sharing, as it's been called, it's not simply enough to say, well, I don't want to look at that. You also have to try to not look at what all of your friends are posting on all of these sites. And so what you run into is a case where you may choose to watch a video once, but then you're going to come across it at least a couple dozen more times as other people are sharing it. And that raises a lot of questions. I mean, this is important information. It's obviously a very newsworthy event, especially in this part of the country. But at the same time, what happens to us as we're seeing these pieces of information, these videos, and these horrible pictures? You cannot unsee them,
right,
and you also can't stop seeing other people putting them in front of you.
Well, the other part of it that we saw so many examples of unbelievable show of human spirit and help And let's move on to that. This crowdsourcing helping, great examples of the web being used as a collective resource to help.
Yeah, the Boston Globe put together those spreadsheets for the people who had, a place for stranded marathoners to stay, or for stranded marathoners to try and seek help, seek a place to stay while they were stuck in town. There was a hashtag on Twitter serving the same purpose. It was Boston Help, and you saw a ton of traffic on that. And then Google launched the People Finder so that individuals could say, "I am okay. I'm accounted for," or they could search for people they hadn't heard from yet. Here's a point of comparison. I remember after the 9/11 attacks, obviously a very different world on the web at that point. But that same process was unfolding. It just took so much longer. I mean, it was several days, if I remember right, before there was any kind of a site trying to account for the people who may have been missing or for people to try and sign up. What it shows me is that we have these free cloud-based tools now available to us so that if you see a need, if you see a place where you can help, you can put that idea together in a matter of minutes and share it out through social media so that it can become useful right away. There's one caveat, though. The caveat is this: that kind of work all depends on whether or not the servers on the web can handle the load. And right. We did see a lot of bandwidth issues in Boston on Monday. Mm-hmm. And even on the Google sites, even on the Google People Finder, there were a couple of times when I clicked on it and it wasn't available. So that's always an issue.
Something also exposed during Hurricane Sandy because so many servers are sitting, in corridors along the New Jersey Turnpike.
All the ideas are great until you can't access them. Right.
All right. So I'll go back to Hurricane Sandy, where people did misreport a few things on Twitter. Also, after the Newtown tragedy, a few things misreported on Twitter. Getting any better after this tragedy?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, not everybody, of course, but sort of the people who are prominent players in web culture are being a little more cautious. And not only that, but they're encouraging other people to be more cautious. The initial flood of tweets that I saw when the news came out of Boston on Monday was obviously documenting what was happening, people sort of the initial reaction. But the first kind of tweet I remember after that was someone who said, "Don't speculate. We don't know anything yet. Just remember that we don't know anything yet." And I think that was important. That's something you might not have seen for a while in past incidents. And for the false information that was out there, Twitter was a little better at policing itself. The New York Post is sort of the punching bag right now because they were insisting there was a much higher death toll than authorities have said that there was. And so people were putting that news out saying, "This is not credible. That's not matching anything else that anybody's saying." Whereas they might have just, unknowingly retweeted it after a couple of seconds a few years ago. I think, unfortunately, that is because we have been through these kind of incidences so many times in the social media era that we've learned from the past mistakes and we're getting a little more measured in how we respond to it.
Well, and then we have the conspiracy theories we have to wrap, but I did notice some really terrific citizen responses to some of those theories.
The best one was a guy or girl who, man or woman, I should say, registered the domain name BostonMarathonConspiracy.com, and their message, the only page on the site was the following. It said, "I bought this domain to keep some conspiracy theory kook from owning it. Please keep the victims of this event and their families in your thoughts. Thank you."
Well, that's a great way to go forward. Brady Carlson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brady is a host of All Things Considered here at NHPR. He's a regular guest on internet-related topics. Now stay with us for domestic violence in New Hampshire. An event is celebrating the 35th anniversary of a New Hampshire crisis center. They're hoping to point out some terrifically astonishing misperceptions about abuse right here in New Hampshire. We're going to learn more about that when Word of Mouth continues. ¶¶